And we are open a hearing on Senate Bill 1040. And we have with us Senator Wilde to talk about this bill that he sponsored.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Wilde, State Senator, District 8. And I brought forward 1040 in part because last session I had two bills, SB 470 and 475, dealing with notification involving the siting of various facilities, but it was very broad in nature. The governor vetoed both of those bills, even though I did have both Thousand Friends and Oregonians in Action backing both of them. So what they said to me during the interim was, narrow it down, identify the exact facilities that you want to deal with, and bring forward another bill, and very possibly we can support it. Well, Senator Brown actually worked on it during the interim. This started out being her bill, which she stepped away from. I picked it up, and I modified it some. Actually, I toned it down a little. And I brought it forward, and of course, lo and behold, the governor's office was none too pleased about it. And so that is why I put the referral on it, because very much like land use notification did last session, which the governor opposed and the voters passed 80-20, this, I believe, should pass approximately 70-30. And so I do trust the voters of this state, and I am quite willing to put it in front of them, and I am quite certain that they will pass it. So, following debate in the Senate and different things that were put forward to me as being difficult points for various people, what I did was I came up with the 8-7 amendments to the bill and tried to deal with every single issue that might otherwise violate the Americans with Disabilities Act or the Fair Housing Act. And I sat down with legislative counsel. We actually had a roundtable analysis and picking a part of the bill based on each person's expertise. And it was very good debate, and that is what led to the A7 amendments. You will notice significant changes from the original bill. Psychiatric review board facilities have been eliminated from the bill. Drug treatment facilities have been eliminated from the bill. These areas, it's debatable, but they do have difficulties, especially with the ADA. And what I wanted to do was come up with a bill that, if challenged in court, would stand up to every single challenge. And that is what I did as a guideline for coming up with the A7 amendment. And I lost all sorts of things that I really did like in the original bill. However, I do want it to sustain a court challenge. I do not like these initiatives that end up being thrown out. Now, one thing I did change was the insurance requirements. They're significantly lowered. I talked to people in this state, which I think was a mistake. What I finally did was I called out to Ohio and Cincinnati, where there are a couple of major firms that do the underwriting of this type of liability insurance. I could find out what was the standard throughout the United States, and the wording you'll see on page 2 of the Dash 7 amendments is exactly a standard policy that is sold throughout the United States. And so I would argue that no group should be able to come up and say this is exorbitant. Many, many states require policies such as this. In dealing with this, I did go and I did not make this, I took out the retroactivity of this. All current facilities are grandfathered in under the A7 amendments. Obviously, it's at your discretion what you want to do with that. But you might possibly want to consider applying these insurance standards retroactively. Even though you might not eliminate current facilities, I think it would be very wise to require the insurance for current facilities. You also might want to go and have notification of those facilities that are already in the neighborhood so that people can be aware of what is in their neighborhood. I mean, it does allow them to make choices as to where they want to live and what they would like to live near. But once again, that is not in the A7. That is at your discretion as to what you wish to do with that. I also changed the form in which notification would have to take place. I was amazed, actually, in analyzing the original bill, or the A and Gross version, that there was no floor debate whatsoever on the requirement that you have 5 consecutive days of publication in an 8x10 format, which would be immensely expensive, probably more expensive than the insurance. And yet no one brought up that issue, and it's funny because the more I thought about that, you'll see my modification is that you must have 4 column inches in the notice section, which is considerably cheaper, and actually a standard format for any notice, any legal notice of any kind. And I don't know that a lot of people would read it in the notice column, but it does meet a legal standard of notice. And so that is why I did it with that minimum 4 column inches, though, which is not exceedingly expensive. That pretty much runs, I deleted quite a bit, actually, from the original bill. You'll see quite a few lines deleted, and what I wanted to do was withstand court challenges, and I think, I am quite certain, talking to quite a number of legal scholars at this point, that the A7 will definitely withstand court challenges, but it does narrow down the bill significantly.
Senator Wild, so they were covering the liability insurance with $1 million per facility?
Yep. What they said was that the standards I put in might be applied to, say, a very large Goodwill facility or something like that, but would not be a group home facility. A group home of 5, which is a pretty standard one.
I'm thinking of some of them out there that are 10, 15 member facilities. They're on rehab programs with rap sheets. Each one of them is worth $1 million worth of liability in a community if they go berserk. What's the deal here? $1 million is what I carry on my own residential
precise
location.
It's a normal standard policy, actually, for many businesses, and above and beyond that would be an umbrella policy. As I said, the standard policy would be a $1 million no matter how it's written, and then you'd get, under my previous wording, you'd get a $9 million additional rider above and beyond the standard policy. Once again, this is at the discretion of the committee. What I tried to do was come up, believe it or not, with something very reasonable.
Yeah. What I would like you to, for the record, though, is to tell us a little bit of the problem that we're trying to take care of.
Well, for me, especially, one of the things that this bill will not now address and troubles me deeply is the issue of an unadjudicated sex offender. Those people who have not stood trial because of their mental incapacity and yet have quite definitely committed crimes. Anyone else would be considered to have committed the crime, however, because of their mental inability to stand trial, they have not even been adjudicated, they have not even been found not guilty by reason of insanity. That type of person can be put in a group home in a neighborhood with no notification, no statement of any kind to anyone in the area, and that really worries me both as to liability should they go out and commit a crime. Because I'll tell you, right now, the CSRB allows people to take day hikes away, not day hikes, hour-long, 90-minute hikes away from their group home without anyone accompanying them. And I mean, these are people who were found not guilty by reason of insanity. It might be murder, it might be rape, it might be something else. But those people are allowed to leave without anyone accompanying them. That, once again, worries me tremendously, but in order to comply with the ADA, which I think, personally, I wouldn't mind challenging that part. But in order to make this an airtight bill, I went and eliminated that. But once again, as we move people back into the community from detention facilities, you can put a murderer out in a group home at this time and not tell anyone. As long as you keep five people. Five is considered a family. They don't have to be related in any way. They don't have to have related crimes. But five can be considered a family and therefore be put into a family resident situation without any notification, without any say among the neighbors. And I do not think that is fair. I think the pendulum swung way too far in establishing that standard. And what you can see is what happened in Washington, where they have passed something very similar to my original 1040, not the watered-down version. And they passed it unanimously, I will tell you. But, of course, Washington is significantly different than Oregon. And so what happened was a woman from a group home, a rapist, went out and raped and murdered a woman's child. She ran for office based on that, and she was the one who ushered the bill through the legislature. She currently is involved in a lawsuit with the state of Washington for $40 million. And I think she has good reason to not only be angry, but to seek the maximum amount of funds that the jury will allow, because the state knew that person was dangerous. They put them in a community setting with no notification whatsoever so people could not take action or be prepared for something like that happening. And I'll tell you, I get tired of the good progressive liberals coming out and saying, these people have rights and therefore we must support them. What happens to the rest of the people? Jeez, I get tired of that. So anyway, that's what this bill is all about. And I really hope you'll look upon it safely.
That's not true. Yeah, thank you. Senator, you said you just started out as Senator Brownsville. That was dealing with another she had a concept to begin with, especially dealing with methadone clinics. Is that where this started?
That was one of her bills. This actually, the original LC of this, was her bill. Now, I modified it slightly, not tremendously, for the original 1040. But, I mean, there were certain things, such as the prohibition distance from schools, or at that time it was daycare centers. I switched that to licensed daycare centers. Was 1,500 feet. I lowered that to 750 feet, which I don't believe to be onerous. I mean, what I did was I sat down with a map and started spinning compass circles at 750 feet around just the schools, and I decided that 1,500 in parts of Portland might be a little large. But once again, personally, I wouldn't mind if it were 1,500, but I tried to tone it down and be as reasonable as I possibly could. But the original LC for this bill was actually Senator Brown's LC.
I guess I had talked to the senator about her bill and her concern to her neighborhood, and I can certainly understand that concern because of the type of person that's going to be coming into a neighborhood they might not normally be coming into. And I think that's a logical question. I see it being more threatening to have murderers and rapists than drug addicts in neighborhoods.
Well, it also is much easier to defend yourself against dealing with that in the courts than it is methadone clinics, because in fact, a person involved in going through a methadone clinic has not necessarily been found guilty of anything. They have probably or possibly not even been charged with anything. And so this, the toned-down version of this deals exclusively with people who have gone through the criminal justice system and have been found guilty and have been ordered to serve time or a sentence of some type. And so, I mean, we have, it's really narrowed down, very focused and scoped.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for the record we should note that Senator Brown voted against the bill as it now stands. And is it your intent solely to provide notice of group homes? Is that your concern?
No, Mr. Chairman.
It's not those five-person group homes that you're concerned about anymore.
Anymore would be an incorrect statement. I have always been broadening my focus. That is why I had SB 470 and 475 last session, which were quite broad. Detention facilities in terms of probation offices, which do attract that same type of clientele, you might say, which in North Portland was a very big issue when I was running for office.
As I read the statute, youth offenders, as defined in ORS 419, is anyone 12 to 18 who has been found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. It doesn't relate to the seriousness of the crime. You're talking about rapists and murderers. I think that some juveniles come within the jurisdiction of the court for some pretty small offenses or perhaps having been offended against. It seems to me that that might still be a concern. I'll tell you frankly that I am not interested in, I am a liberal, and I'm not very interested in your measure. Having a nephew who's in a group home, not in this state, but I know the difficulty firsthand of establishing such facilities. And particularly the fact that it doesn't seem to give any recognition to the supervision in those facilities. I mean, it's not five unsupervised people. They may be allowed out for an hour at a time. But when we're talking about people going berserk, that's not my idea of the kinds of people I see within my district who have formerly been institutionalized, perhaps been under the juvenile court at one time or another. They may not always act appropriately, but I'll tell you this, for the most part, I believe that they are people who have enriched our lives in many ways, enriched neighborhoods in which they belong. And so it's going to take a lot of convincing for me that it's a good thing to run a newspaper ad and tar those juveniles further and say, watch out. Here are folks coming to your neighborhood. Who's going to ever cite a facility after that? Or is that your intent?
Personal, or would you like a response?
Is that your intent, that to make it more difficult to cite such facilities?
My intent is that we have some balance in this. Right now, there is no balance. You can cite this, period. At any time, in any home in the state of Oregon, at any spot. And that is a balance that is a non-existent balance. There is no balance in that. I believe you should have to go through a citing process. You have to cite a prison. You have to cite a business oftentimes if it's a change in zoning. I mean, I'll tell you, you're more protected as a neighborhood if you put in a 7-Eleven than if you put in a home for rapists. I'm sorry, that is not balanced. And in the subject that was brought up, I know there will be an amendment brought forward to exclude OYA facilities. I personally, although I don't sit on the committee, I would appreciate it if that would be rejected. I believe they should be included in this. But obviously on this issue, I'm not going to convince the people, all of the people. But what I want is to get this before the voters so that they can decide. And with, I believe, 88 neighborhood associations in the Portland metro area endorsing this bill, I have a feeling it's going to do pretty well.
Senator Wilder, what's occurring in your district? Is it similar to what occurred in mine? I think we have some, and you and I have talked about this, we have some purposes for siting some of these facilities, and they come under some quite specific statutory regulation, but then there's others that are not. And what has occurred in my district in Southwest Eugene is siting of a house that was supposed to have five members. It's within a single family zone residential area. The community did not act for it. The agreement through, and I went through with them, the siting process. There's plenty of testimony. The siting officer did not listen to the community. And presently, the people have kept records that live around the site. It's in the same block as the school, elementary school. We have people coming and going. It's supposed to be a rehab, drunk and disorderly. 15 members they have, and their friends coming in, and cars parked are all around the streets. A very large problem. And this is just one house, sited in single-family zone residential. I think in our instance, we've gone too far, certainly. What some of that happening in Portland, too?
A great deal, which is why this bill was originally brought forward by Senator Brown, because in the Buckman district of her district, actually, even Congressman Blumenauer has agreed, and he's made a statement both in writing and verbally, that that spot, that area, probably has the highest density of these type facilities of anywhere in the entire United States, and he requested to find out why it is they could be sited in the way they were and why they were being so concentrated in that area. Well, if you look at the political clout from that area, both with local governments and at times with the state government, it's not excessive. They are not of high economic income. And yet it's amazing the way they stay away from the areas that do have political clout. And so I don't think it's been fair at all. In my part, yes, in North Portland, there are a great number of these facilities. It's quite simple to put them in. And put in a different perspective. This is a business, period. If I want to do a business, one, I have to get a business license. But if I am in an area that is not zoned for business, I must go through a zone change. It is standard. This is one of those few exceptions where they simply say, well, we'll waive that. It's in the best interest of the people. Or, I'm sorry, if you required a zone change, it would have the same impact. You would have hearings. You would have notification to those around the area. You would have the exact same thing. All I'm doing is going and saying, yes, you can go and put them in these areas other than within 750 feet of a licensed daycare center or a school, or you've got to go through the hearings process, or you have to at least have notification that you're going to put these in.
Now, we have changed policy in the state of Oregon from the larger facilities and removing our investment in the larger facilities, and so now we are placing our individuals back in the communities in smaller facilities. And so we do have to address that. But how have we done that? Is it, in your mind, without a lot of forethought, or
both? I strongly opposed the closing of Fairview last session. I hung out to the bitter end on that because California's example, I sat on Human Resources last session, and And California has clearly shown there will be people who will be failures in the community, regardless of the facility that was put in place. And California now is backpedaling and looking much more at having rebuilding state facilities, because they were trying to go to all group homes if at all possible. And there are people who will be failures. And right now the state has nowhere to put those people. And that really bothers me. I think it was done with very little foresight. I think it was a tremendous mistake on the part of the state. But once again, I put my vote as far as I could put it, where my mouth was, and that's about all I can do. And so if we're going to go this route, I'm not going to let it be a suicidal path. I'm going to keep fighting this regardless of whether it goes through the session or not. I think it will go through the session, but if it doesn't, it might give me cause to run for re-election, so, which I would prefer not having, quite honestly. I've got two little kids, and I'd rather take care of those guys. But if need be, I'll do what I have to do.
Thank you, Senator Bob. Any other questions?
Sure.
Representative Merkley.
Senator Wild, I'm looking at page here, Amendment 87, in line 2 of the first page, where you note monitoring primarily in persons. Can you tell us what the word primarily is intended to mean in this context?
That was Legislative Council's decision to put that in, and the idea was that if you had, say, a church or another facility that had a primary purpose, it was not this type of activity, that in fact we would not preclude them from involving themselves with this type of clientele, you might say, because the argument, or an attorney, these were things that came up in the hearing on the Senate side, which was that an attorney who writes a will for somebody who at one time was a murderer might in fact have to go and give notice to the neighborhood. Well, that was not the intent. I mean, are they primarily dealing with this type of client, and is it their primary intent to have this be their business? And if in fact that is merely one of many clients who come through the facility, but it is not the primary type with which they deal. And I will tell you, Legislative Council believes through court decisions that primary has been well established as to its meaning and intent. And so I did not choose to define it, because, which I was going to do, but they said it is not necessary because there have been many court challenges of this sort of wording.
Mr. Chair, additional question?
Yes, follow up.
Line 3 of A7 says convicted of crimes. Can you tell us what the breadth of crimes includes?
But we had originally, in the original SB 1040, was charged with or convicted of a crime. That charged with dealt with such as unadjudicated sex offenders or that sort of thing. Because of the ADA, we dropped the charge with. Convicted of is exactly what it says, convicted of a crime.
Does this include traffic offenses?
If you're going to house somebody in one of these facilities for a traffic offense, I would say that's a rather extreme sentence, but if that is the case.
So crime includes misdemeanors in this context?
It includes anyone who will be housed in a facility such as this for having committed a crime, and that will be the determination of the court.
Additional questions? If I have a residential facility, and I'm a psychiatrist, if you will, and my practice office adjoins my house, and I work primarily with people, or to say a majority of my clients have committed some crime in their life, including traffic offenses, or perhaps even more serious offenses. would this affect my ability to have my office in the neighborhood?
If you were to provide notifications to the community, and I was quite, once again, as written in this, existing facilities are grandfathered in. That may change depending on certain people's desires, but if you go through the process and you have been granted your business license, which I hope you have, because that is a business, yes, it would impact you, absolutely.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. I have a number of other questions. Mentioned briefly, but I'd like to have a chance to come back to at a later point on it. Senator Weil, I'd just like to mention quickly, you've noted that many states provide this wording. Could you please give us a list of the states and the wording they provide?
I cannot.
And second, you've noted that you've spoken with many legal scholars. Could we please have their names and their accreditations?
Is this standard for your committee?
I think it's very important to understand
I'll give you Dave Hendricks. You can go to, because Dave Hendricks, his specialty is in the ADA.
I'd appreciate it if you could just give us this information in writing, because a lot of people are waiting to testify. And the third question I have is, you noted your main goal is to address unadjudicated sex offenders, for example, those not guilty by virtue of insanity. I'd like to understand how big a problem this is. Maybe you could give us a list of how many people not guilty by virtue of insanity are inhabiting our neighborhoods.
Mr. Chair, I'll deny that request because, as I said, this bill no longer deals with those people, and so it's irrelevant.
Yeah, that's fair.
Doesn't this conclusion of not guilty by virtue of insanity, isn't that in essence a judicial finding?
But once again, all PSRBs issues have been removed from the bill.
They're removed.
And as such, we can discuss it.
So your primary reason for bringing this bill has really been eliminated by the change in the amendment?
No, that is how I opened. I do have many reasons for bringing it. One of which is just citing a detention facility such as probation officers, which is what originally got this whole issue going in my district.
And the last question I would have, if you could get back to us, is you've noted 88 neighborhood associations have endorsed this bill. A list of those would be very helpful.
That would be fine. And I'm sure it'll be on the ballot in the voter's pamphlet as well.
Well, I'd like to have it for this committee to be able to understand the breadth of support for what you're doing.
All right. We will move on. I thank you, Senator Weil, very much for coming forward. Representative Mesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'm Ken Messerly, State Representative for District 48, which is Coos Bay south of the California border. I received a fax was in my office when I came to my office yesterday afternoon from Bob Baloney Ranch Incorporated. It was signed by Mr. Gary Hansen, the Executive Director. In Coos County, we have two ranches, a girls' home and a boys' home. The boys' home is situated along Highway 101 in the middle of forest land, no neighbors at all. The girls' home is neighbors to where I live. And there's other homes in the vicinity. It is a rural setting, but the lots, I'm guessing, are probably anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 acres. My experience with the girls' home has been absolutely excellent. We have never had any incidents with them. We've never heard any sounds. The girls are very well supervised and just have had no problems at all. In discussions with my neighbors, I'm not aware of any problems they've ever had. The letter I received from Mr. Hansen is very concerned about this bill, and I apologize. I haven't had time to call him back and make sure that he was aware of the amendments that have come forth. But let me just list some of the concerns he has. His first concern is that it would be virtually eliminate our consideration of Duval if providing new needed treatment services to the community. Examples of Proctor homes, treatment foster homes, etc. Because of the lengthy timelines, the bill would dictate and the additional costs. His second concern is that the bill's requirements around security supervision, etc., for facilities such as ours are redundant. Our contractual and licensing requirements already cover these issues. His third concern is the bonding for the liability insurance. And I'm not sure this is up to date with the amendments because although the fax was sent June 18th, the letter included with that fax was dated April 14th. So this could be out of alignment with the amendments. But his insurance agent estimates an additional cost of $16,000 to $20,000 just for the additional liability insurance. These programs are very needed. I don't disagree with some of the concerns the senator just spoke to you about, but I think we need to be very careful that we don't make it impossible for some other facilities such as these to honor. I've been to their Christmas party, I think, for the last 3 years, tremendously impressed with the not only the struggles that these young people are going through, but the supervision they have and the progress they make. These homes take in patients from Curry County, Douglas County, and I think even beyond that maybe. If they have an open bed and it's on a priority basis, depending on the needs of the patients, they do bring them in from other counties. I think we need many more of these facilities. They're more like a boot camp than they are anything else. They have classes. They bring them along with their education as well as just simply teaching these young people how to live and how to conduct their lives and how to treat people. So I would just hope that this bill will be amended, if it comes out at all, that it's amended not to put extra burden on these homes, which we need so much. Representative Taylor, by the way, gave me the perfect segue into my concerns.
Excellent. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Mezzoli. I appreciate it. Karen Brazel, Oregon Youth Authority. I'm not worried about it.
Mr. Chair and representatives of the committee, my name is Karen Brazeau, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And I want to confirm what Representative Mezzoli talked about, the homes that we spoke of are under contract with the Oregon Youth Authority for juvenile offenders, so yes, they are included in that bill. And I would like to start by agreeing with Senator Wild on a couple of points. There are some problems, and they're particularly in the metro area, and they have to do with the oversaturation on programs serving all kinds of disenfranchised people that become concentrated in particular areas, not for political reasons at all, but because of economic reasons. Those are neighborhoods where the housing is cheap, and these private nonprofit groups purchase those facilities because they can't afford them and because they are on public transportation lines and they're close to other services. It is not about political power. It is about the absolute fact that you can buy a home as a private nonprofit business, you can afford to buy a home in the Buckman neighborhood, and you cannot afford to buy one in the West Hills. And you won't find these homes in the West Hills because of that very reason. The other issue that I would like to agree with him on is if there is an initiative about this, I believe that it will pass. And I believe it will pass because it will say something like, would you like to have an offender living next to you? And the answer is no. But what the initiatives would not say is the rest of the story, meaning that whether or not you have them living next to you under supervision and in these programs, they will be living next to you because Oregon has established a system that moves these people. And in my case, I will talk about juvenile offenders. And I want you to understand we're talking about youth who are over the age of 12 and up to the age of 18. And they are youth who have not been convicted of a Measure 11 offense, which, you know, are very serious offenses and allow them to be waived into adult court where they come under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections. They are not younger youth who have committed very serious crimes and get waived into adult court. So we're talking about juveniles who primarily have committed any crime is low level, but on the range of seriousness, they're relatively low level crimes. Kids fighting, engaging in drug and alcohol abuse, illegal possession, burglar or property offenses, that sort of thing, that haven't risen to the level of causing serious personal damage. Those youth do come through the juvenile court system, and without either the state's or the county's ability to establish treatment programs at the county level or in the state's case to provide residential services, those youth will return back to the homes that they came from without the supervision that kept them out of trouble in the first place. So if I kind of paint probably everybody's worst case nightmare, is a 12-year-old who has been playing around with fire, set his neighbor's garage on fire, and it's determined to be more than just an accident. Without our ability to move that youth into a home that provides the appropriate treatment and supervision, that kid's going back to his same home, probably next to his neighbor whose garage he burned down, without the supervision that would have prevented that from happening in the first place. So if this bill passes, if an initiative passes, these people will still be living in our communities, these kids. The state has established a system, for better or worse, that has a relatively small number of youth who are incarcerated in state-operated lockdown facilities and a great number of youth who are supervised and served in the community. The philosophical underpinning behind this system is that deviant people, youth in particular, have a better chance of being normal when they're with other normal people than with other deviant people. And this is where I would have to agree with Senator Wilde that in some cases, as a state representative and representative for the state in charge of these young people, that starts falling apart when I have places in neighborhoods where they're not living next to normal family homes, but they're living next to methadone clinics, etc. So I do agree there is a problem. This bill only addresses one side of the problem, and that's the neighborhood's concern. It doesn't address the concerns of the state that is required to supervise these youth, and it doesn't look at the youth's best interest in reformation. Further, there are some issues in the bill that just don't make sense to me. For example, all juvenile offenders, I mean, I can think of one example, so I'm still pretty confident saying all, are required to attend school as a part of their probation or parole. So they would be, but this bill would not allow them to live next to the very schools that they are by law required to attend. It also presents some legal challenges for state agencies who are in the system that the state has set up. The Youth Authority, for example, spends 40% of its budget on these community-based programs. This is privatization. This is dealing with private nonprofit organizations. And because they are private businesses, they establish where they will locate. The state doesn't govern that the way we do our own facilities. This bill would very much muddy, and I'm not sure even the legal ramifications of our ability to contract the way where we are required to have a relationship with a private provider before we even establish a contract with them. Current state contracting laws don't allow us to do that. I think I've probably said all that I will say about it. There are others waiting to testify behind me. I think we'll talk to you about the legal challenges that are sure to come from this bill. Let me give you an example. In the Buckman neighborhood, there was a legal challenge that was brought up by the Neighborhood Association against the siting of that facility, and because 80% of the kids in the juvenile justice system are considered to have learning disabilities and drug and alcohol problems, they do fall under the protections of the ADA. Whether you like that or agree with it or don't, that's just, right now, that is the legal side. I'll stop and answer any questions you might have.
This is a very complex problem, and there are compelling issues on both sides of it. I was wondering if for the OYA, is there any kind of statistical information that's been gathered about the impact that the facilities have on the neighborhoods?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, I'm not sure what you mean by impact.
Well, it seems to me that one of the concerns with the neighborhood of the neighboring property owners are that there suddenly are all of these young people in the neighborhood that they would probably hope weren't there. And I was wondering if there was any information about, do they cause problems? Is there any kind of reporting kept about incidents that are caused in the neighborhoods by the kids?
Representative Welch and Representative Morgan, I wish I could tell you that 6% or whatever make problems in the neighborhood. I can't. I can go back and look at specific reports from some of those facilities and see if I could pull that out for you. Certainly, if any of these youth commit law violations, and whether it's in their neighborhoods or out of their neighborhoods, because they are under supervision, those are dealt with. I believe, though, that it is not possible and doesn't get to the root of the problem to try to narrow this to a particular kind of person, whether they're an offender or at the methadone clinic. I know in working with the Buckman neighbors, what they communicated to me, I certainly can't speak for them, but that is the house that the programs that we contract were the only ones in their neighborhood that, even though they're kids, they probably wouldn't have had a problem. It's that they have our contract, they have a methadone clinic that's established on the neighborhood, they have a church running a soup kitchen. They have a lot of people, youth and adults, with problems in their neighborhood. And this bill certainly would help them address a small piece by essentially limiting and largely prohibiting the siting of youth or adult offender programs in their neighborhood. But it does nothing to address the other larger issues. My recommendation would be that this body, if you want to do something meaningful, think about establishing a task force that looks at all sides of this. It's not a huge problem in more rural parts of the state, but it is in more metro areas of the state. And in fact, the metro area itself is dealing with this, and we are working with the city of Portland and their Office of Neighborhood Involvement of how to mitigate some of the problems. Senator Brown's bill, 1104, which does require neighbor notification and neighbor involvement in the siting, did pass and was supported by all sides of the bill as one step forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, we need to move on to some more hearing.
Okay. So let's go ahead with more chat.
Thank you very much. Kathy Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. For those of you who don't know what Juvenile Rights Project is, we're a nonprofit public interest law firm in Portland that represents only children. We represent children in abuse and neglect cases, in delinquency cases, in Measure 11 cases, and then we do statewide advocacy for children. I've been a staff attorney with Juvenile Rights Project for the last 9.5 years. My specialty is the delinquent children, specializing mostly in the most serious delinquents that Portland has to offer. We are opposed to this bill for many of the reasons that Karen Bezos just told you. The fact of the matter is that we need more of these programs out in the community, not less of them. We have kids every day that are going to lock up all around the state of Oregon, I don't mean like McLaren, Hillcrest, to the OIA, youth correctional facilities, that probably would not have to be there if there were programs available for them in the community. Let me give you an example. The drug and alcohol programs, the wait lists on youth, there are 60 residential drug and alcohol beds in the state of Oregon for youth. The wait list is usually somewhere between 6 to 8 months. I often will have clients sitting there looking at me, begging me to get them into drug and alcohol treatment, begging me to get them in. We can't get them in to a residential drug and alcohol treatment program. They go back to their home, unsupervised, into the same situation that essentially brought them to the drug and alcohol program, and commit more crimes. And they commit more crimes, and they commit more crimes, and they commit more crimes, and sooner or later they end up going to McLaren or Hillcrest. Reason being is because we can't get them into a residential drug and alcohol treatment program. As for the ADA problems, I'm telling you right now, this bill does not, even the modifications, does not solve the ADA problems, especially as regarding the youth offenders. By history, I can tell you that our organization sued McLaren when they did not comply with the requirements put up by the state in terms of their facilities. We won. We sued Multnomah County. And their detention facilities did not come up to the requirements. We required them, and the consent decree required that they build a new facility. So I cannot tell you that Juvenile Rights Project definitely will file a lawsuit if this bill passes. I can tell you it will certainly rise in our level of lawsuits to seriously consider, because the ADA problems would not be addressed. As for the problems that exist out there with programs, there are problems that exist. And I can tell you right now that since the Oregon Youth Authority was established in 1995, they have closed two programs in Senator Wild's district because of problems with supervision and because of concerns about the neighbors. That was Beyond Home and the MyCAP home, which was both located in Northeast Portland. And those homes probably should have been closed, having had clients there and having gone and visited them on several occasions. But I can also tell you that because of the closure of those two facilities, along with a few others that OIA have closed in the metro area, I have seen a vast improvement in the other facilities in terms of the monitoring that they're doing of the youth. Certainly those facilities don't want their contract ended because they aren't supervising the youth that are in their care. So they're certainly taking more concern and more effort into making sure that those youth are supervised, and I personally am seeing less of a problem. The next thing that I want to let you know is the youth that come into these facilities. They come in both after while they're on probation and then once they're off on parole. Okay, so you're dealing with two different types of kids that would enter these facilities. The youth that are on probation could be your 12-year-old who got into a fight at school. But because of that fight at school, when people start looking into the family, what we realize is that there's significant family problems, and therefore it's important for us to pull the youth out of the family, work with both the family and the youth so we could reunite the family and the youth so that first of all, the family problems are dealt with, but also so there's no other future delinquent behavior. SDF does not deal with these kids. Okay, so a lot of these kids, if they're SDF kids, they don't deal with them after they're 12 years old. SDF will come up here and tell you, we don't have the facilities for them. If there aren't the facilities in OYA, then we're trying to deal with the family and the kids in an explosive situation that keeps exploding. And we can't keep them apart long enough to get both of them so that they can get back together and the situation does not explode. I can give you many examples of that. But certainly one of them is a client of mine by the name of Josiah. He came into the jurisdiction of the court for essentially fighting with his mom, hitting his mom. Okay? He came in, we got him into contact. What we found was that there were significant behavioral problems. He got sent after several probation violations of blowing up at home, running away from home, not going to school. He got sent to the Parrot Creek Ranch, which is actually in Clackamas County. The Parrot Creek Ranch worked with his parents, with him, and actually with another member of the community who had become very close to Josiah, and we were able to work him back home. He's now living at home, off of probation, doing very well in school. I mean, he's a success story. When you look at the kids on probation, what happens is there's a certain number of kids that come into the juvenile justice system. Some of them, just getting arrested, they aren't going to do it again, right? Some of them, once they're adjudicated, that's probably enough, having gone through the court system. There's others that go on probation and can live at home, and that probation and supervision at the home is enough that they don't do it again. The next level down needs those residential treatment facilities, those facilities that we're talking about right now. There are kids that go to those facilities and then go back home and we never hear from them again. They don't go back into the juvenile justice system. They don't go back into the criminal justice system. We then see the next level of kids which go to end up being committed to an OYA youth correctional facility. And when those kids get out, if they don't have, and those are the second group of kids that I talked to you about, if they don't have a structured environment to go to help them get back into the community, what we see is a high recidivism rate, a high return back to OYA. An example of that is the Burn Grant program, which is happening in Oregon, in Portland right now. What we are seeing is that a high overrepresentation of minority youth. And we were wondering why minority youth kept coming back and back and back. And what we are finding is that a lot of minority kids are going back into bad situations. So the Burn Grant program has put high emphasis in terms of putting high structure on these kids, no matter where they're living, to help them reintegrate into the community. It's been very successful. And what we're seeing is less minority kids going back to an OYA youth correctional facility. Now, that program and the programs above that, right before the youth correctional facility, those are the programs we're talking about. If we can't cite those programs, if those programs cease to exist, what you're going to see is more kids going into a youth correctional facility here in Oregon, which is going to cost us, first, more money. Second, it's going to be a stigma on those kids. And third, those are kids that may not have to be there, and therefore, it's a vicious cycle sometimes when you get into that slippery slope. You start going down the slope, and those kids will, you know, for any child, an expert will tell you, a child will behave the way adults around them expect the child to behave. And if that child starts to think of himself or herself as a criminal, we're going to see bad things happening in our criminal justice system here in Oregon. I don't think that's what you want. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you.
I appreciate your comments. That was real interesting. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings about where the crossover is in protecting the adjoining property owner's property rights and still allowing these programs to continue?
Chair Welsh, Representative Morgan, as a member of the Buckman neighborhood, I can tell you that I understand the concerns of the people in that neighborhood. I mean, I live there. And I think the problem exists with that Karen Brazil talked. The oversaturation does exist in the Buckland neighborhood, but it's not for political reasons. It is because of economic reasons. I don't go visit group homes in the West Hills of Portland. I don't go visit group homes too much down in Southwest Portland. And it's because of the expense and the location in terms of the kids being able to get to and from school, to and from the programs. I think that it's important that the people, the neighbors, are aware of the program. And, in fact, the more successful programs I've seen are programs where the neighborhood actually embraces the program and gets involved with some of the kids. That's what these kids need. They need the community to be welcoming them. I think that Senator Brown's bill, 1104, will go a long way to let those neighborhood associates. I think part of the political feeling was we have no say in what's going on. We have no notice about what's happening. That goes to the notice, and that goes to getting at least the neighborhoods involved. And I would hope that if the neighborhoods met some of these kids and took the chance to become involved with the program, what they would see is that these are not, you know, super predator kids. These are not, you know, horrible, horrible individuals. These are kids. I mean, we're talking about 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds who are scared, they're lonely, they don't know what to do, they don't have an adult in their life. So I guess the way to weigh that is, and I really hate this saying, but I think there's some truth in saying that it takes a village to raise a child. And we have to decide here in Oregon, you know, are we going to let our fear conquer our fear of our children, mean that we're going to throw some children away? I don't think that's the right thing. And I think that if neighborhood associations thought about it, certainly there's concern about over-separation, but if neighborhoods associations knew what was going on and took the chance to come in and be involved in the programs, they would see them in a whole different light.
Kathy, I appreciate it. Ed Patterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I just have some brief comments regarding the way the bill is constructed. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1040A would include existing facilities unless the -7 amendments are adopted, and that's one of our concerns. But it would be particularly onerous for community hospitals across the state which offer a variety of services that would come under the purview of this law. For example, many hospitals offer a variety of drug and alcohol treatment programs that would be covered under this law. The law would even appear to cover hospitals offering services such as outpatient drug counseling. The bill would apply to prisoners and other individuals in police custody who are treated, monitored, or rehabilitated in the hospital. This could include accident victims who are charged with reckless driving, driving under the influence, etc., who clearly don't pose a threat to the surrounding community during the course of their treatment in the hospital. Most significantly, hospitals are already meeting the goals of Senate Bill 1040 by ensuring that these services are offered in a secure environment that minimizes any threat to the surrounding community. Existing state and federal regulations, along with internal policies developed pursuant to the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, require that hospitals safeguard patients, staff, and the community when providing medical, psychiatric, or rehabilitation services. Similar protections may not exist in non-hospital community facilities. While Senate Bill 1040 may be targeting a community-based treatment program servicing high-risk clients, it has captured a wide variety of services currently offered by community hospitals. Mr. Chair, I had distributed a copy of Senate Bill 1040 with some suggested marked-up amendments in it, and also amendments to Senate Bill 1040. Senator Wild, the sponsor of the original bill, had consented to exempting hospitals from this existing bill, and that amendment had been drafted, but due to some time constraints, the amendment was not out of legislative council, did not ever get entered into the original bill. I believe Senator Wild still supports existing hospitals, and what I would like to do is to make this committee aware that we think hospital that is defined in ORS 442-015 should be exempt from the requirements of the bill. It's difficult for me to address, not knowing what's going to happen with the Dash 7 amendments, but if there is a work group put together, or if this bill does move forward, I would ask that our amendment be considered, and I'd be happy to work with any group that is put together to work on, to develop the bill further. That concludes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? For the benefit of those in the room, is our intent to close the committee at 10 o'clock? And carry this bill over to Wednesday. So we'll hear from Paul Snyder next. We'll go as far as we can. Try not to close it to him. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Snyder, and I represent the Association Board and County. I'm appearing this morning in opposition to Senate Bill 1040. I expect from the testimony already given that I should confine my remarks to the Dash A7 amendments, but if the A and Gross Bill were to go forward, we'd have other comments to make. I think it's important to recognize that Senate Bill 1040 is an effort to address some legitimate concerns. It can be recognized that there are issues involving communities that should be addressed and should be honored. There are issues involving the facilities that need to be cited that should also be honored, and it's a matter of balancing the two. We endorse a number of the remarks already that have been made by the Juvenile Rights Project and the Youth Authority, so I won't repeat those things. I'd like to address primarily my comments to the bill, to the Dash A7 amendments, and the questions that I have about the language. For example, Representative Merkley pointed out the issue of what does the word primarily mean, and I thought I pretty much already knew that until I heard the response from Senator Wilde, and now I'm not sure. The response that I heard Senator Wilde give was to say that it's intended to confine its application to avoid, for example, that it would not cover an attorney who writes a will for a person who may have been convicted of a crime sometime in the past. I wouldn't have thought the language would apply to an attorney anyway, because it's not somebody who's providing treatment, rehabilitation, detention, or monitoring, but now I'm not sure of that. Suppose it's a criminal defense lawyer. And suppose that criminal defense lawyer it primarily focuses on representing people who have been convicted of crimes or accused of having committed crimes. I think that issue should be clarified with respect to the example that was given, because the opposite of the example kind of raises more questions than the example answers to me. So would it apply to a criminal defense lawyer? If it does, suppose the lawyer moves from one law firm to the other, moves from the Coin Tower to the First Interstate Bank building in downtown Portland. I don't think it was the intent of the sponsor that attorney would give notice to everybody within a half-mile radius of the Coin Tower. That's a question that came up in my mind given the testimony. The reference to youth offenders as defined in ORS 419A004, that does include an awful lot of different kinds of offenses. It includes, looking at the statute, a person under 18 who's committed an act which is a violation of which, if done by an adult, would constitute a violation of a law, ordinance of the United States or a state, county, or city, that seems to include everything down to municipal ordinances, although it also would involve the court taking jurisdiction. So I don't imagine a juvenile court would take jurisdiction for a parking offense, but there are an awful lot of circumstances where the court could take jurisdiction. Another question is the reference to provider. It's not clear to me whether this bill is intended to cover government units. It refers to person, publicly funded professional, or team of professionals. Again, the general statute is ORS 174-100 says person includes individuals, corporations, associations, firms, partnerships, limited liability companies, and joint stock companies. Usually that doesn't include government. So But if this bill is intended to cover government units, then I would raise a question about, among other things, the reference to liability insurance in Section 3. We have Tort Claims Act liability coverage. Every government unit does. A lot of government units are self-insured. My question then would be, if this does cover government, why would government be getting liability insurance? And what's the difference between general and professional liability insurance in the context of Section 3? And if it applies to government, then what is directors and officers' liability insurance? I'm not sure. It would be good to get some clarification. The reference to school indicates it does not include post-secondary education institutions, but it doesn't define what it does include. It's obvious that it includes primary and secondary education, but what about some other schools like vocational schools or traffic schools? I wouldn't think it's intended to cover that, but it would be good to get clarification on that. Subsection 2 of Section 2 says if the provider of a proposed facility operates other facilities, and then it goes on to describe what the notice is supposed to include. Provisions of this relate back to the other facilities, but other provisions don't. And it's all preceded by the language that says that if the provider also operates other facilities. So I would question what that's intended to do, which if it were taken literally, you don't know what the notice is supposed to include if the provider does not operate other facilities. And I don't think that's the intent of the measure. Section 3 indicates if the proposed facility is located, and then it goes on to talk about within 750 feet of a school or licensed child care center. Well, if it's proposed, it's not located. If it's located, it's not proposed. And that becomes an issue, I think, because it raises in my mind the question of who got there first. If it's a proposed facility, then that makes some sense. You don't take these people in who are listed here if it's within 750 feet of a school or a licensed child care center. But if your facility is located first and then a child care center moves into the neighborhood, does that mean your facility's got to move out? I think that's another issue that ought to be clarified with respect to the language of the bill. It talks in subsection 2 of section 3 that the facility is a residential facility. You have to have 24-hour staffing, which means that somebody sleeping is not staffing. Well, what if the residential facility doesn't have any patients in it at the time? What I'm thinking about is a foster care situation where the kids have gone to school. Does that mean you can't take a nap? I don't think it's intended to mean that, but again, taken literally, that's another aspect to the bill. Madam Chair, with respect to other issues, I'm assuming that we're talking about the DAS 7 amendments, and so I won't add comments to something that's not under active consideration by the committee. I would mention, though, that there are efforts on the part of governments, including Multnomah County. They've got a facility siting manual that they publish and try to follow with respect to the location of facilities and the involvement of community processes in locating these facilities. So there is an effort on the part of county government to respect and take into account the issues of legitimate nature with respect to communities and community organizations. Thank you for the chance to testify.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Let's go to Dave Austin.
The thing that I wanted to address here is something that really hasn't had anybody speak to, and that involves someone who has committed a crime, who is an adult, who is in a position or situation to be released into the community.
Excuse me, Mr. Ralston, yes. You identify yourself for the record.
David Ralston. And after having heard all the testimony, I really realized the complexity of it. And I'd like to go back a little bit in time because I'm speaking on behalf of my son in particular, as well as all those that are in his situation. He is in the state hospital right now. But at one point he was 14 years old with these kinds of problems that he had with his mental illness. And what I found out as a parent that in looking for treatment, I was pretty much left on my own for him. If I didn't do it, there really wasn't anybody to do it. And as I searched through the communities and through the entire state to find what I could find, what I found out was that in most cases, treatment centers were contracted out, and there was a screening process by which if your son or daughter didn't meet the criteria, then they were not eligible for treatment. And in almost every case, that meant that if you had a son or daughter who was a problem for whatever the treatment center took care of, if they appeared to be an individual that would have trouble or cause trouble, then they were screened out and they didn't have the opportunity. So over and over and over, I found myself in a situation right where I could not get help. And at one point, he did, through the juvenile court system, he ended up in the state hospital as a juvenile for 1 year. And of course, at the age of 18, then you're disqualified from that program, so you're now in the adult portion of that program. His conditions continued to worsen, and I found there really was nothing for me, period, out there, not even hospitalization. At one point, I went to the county to seek commitment for him, and I was essentially told it was a waste of time, that the courts, the most I could get would be a 30-day treatment in the hospital, and the courts considered that if an individual is able to eat out of a garbage can, he was capable of taking care of himself, and that's the extreme that the courts would go to. I tried private hospitals. The funds were very minimal. The most I could get was about a 3-day stay at any time he had a crisis, and even then a 3-day stay wasn't always available if a hospital wasn't there ready to accept him. And as an adult, all he had to do at any time was say, "I want to leave," and he would leave. There was no way to keep him anywhere. And as his condition worsened, I realized that what was going to happen was eventually he was going to commit a crime against himself or somebody, that this was the inevitability of it, that it couldn't happen any other way. There was no other way for this to go. He also became prey to the criminal elements. He had diminished capacity. He didn't have full IQ or ability to reason that we have. And I found people from all over Portland would seem to find him that there were criminals or had been in the criminal system of the state. And I had great difficulty trying to keep him away from those people. There wasn't anybody to really help me do that. In fact, I had someone move in who was had been in the system, criminal system, and I had purchased a small condominium for him to live in. And I asked the police to remove this person. And I was told that in the state of Oregon, if anybody spends one night, overnight, with you, they become a legal occupant. And the only way to remove them is to go through the eviction process. So I couldn't even get any response from the local authorities to help me with that. And in fact, I did go through that eviction process. It was quite an ordeal.
I don't want to rush you, Mr. Wilson, but if you can...
Yes. What I want to say is he committed the crime, but he committed the crime because there was really no other alternative. He did it out of desperation and out of fear. So he ends up in a system where now, for the first time in his life, he is getting better, and it's working for him. And I think it's a marvelous system that we have here, and the opportunity at some point to be released into the community may be jeopardized by this bill. The PSRB has a tight leash on these people. They are not free to do whatever they want. They're under strict requirement for medication, supervision, and so forth. These people will be, at some point, released unconditionally if there is nothing out there. And the notion has existed here somehow that if there are no treatment facilities, then these people will somehow disappear and not be part of our community. And I can tell you they will be in our community. They will be a part of our community
whether this bill passes or not. And the only thing that makes sense to me is to have responsibility and have a means for people to have a life and to be able to live like each of us live. And I'm afraid that they're seriously will be jeopardized by this bill. And this is pretty much my concern today, and I wanted to address that. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Matt, I'm sorry we must adjourn. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 1040 and adjourn for the day. The bill will be passed on Wednesday.